walked up and I said, "It's Watt, isn't it?" And Herbert said, "Yes, honey, he's gone." And he went exactly like you wanted to. He was on his way to an AA meeting. Had a heart attack, and Pete had taken him back to the house. And Joe had called from Chattanooga to see how he was feeling. And Pete said, "Well, I put him in bed. He won't go to the hospital." Joe says, "You make him go." And when Pete hung up the phone and walked around to the bedroom, Watt was dead. And they told me, and I went in the house, and there were at least 50 members of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon in the house. They'd made coffee. They bought great big pots. And they were there waiting to help me get through. And I'll always be grateful for that. My sister didn't understand all this. She thought it was terrible. And I had quite a set to with her about it. But they were there and they carried me through it. Literally. You never seen the food that they brought to my home. I think there were 8 big hams, whole hams, along with everything else. Not so much for me, but because they love Watt. And he had one of the largest funerals that our church had ever seen. They came from everywhere. And it was a real tough deal to get through that. But it made me feel very humble and very proud and very, very grateful that people loved him as much as I did. And I could keep going on that. They didn't just go to the funeral and then leave. They came for weeks because they knew how I was grieving. He's still very much remembered in Shreveport. And I stayed there for several more years. And both my boys had ended up in Atlanta, which was originally my home. And my oldest son called me one day and he said, "Mom, I think it's time for you to come home." And I said, "Let me think about it." And I thought about it for a little while and called him back and I said, "Come get me." And he did. And he had just recently married. And we got a U-Haul and packed it up with all my stuff. And he drove the U-Haul and I followed him. And we lit out from driving to Atlanta. And we got about to Anniston, Alabama, and I pulled up beside him and I said, "Let's stop and get some coffee. I'm getting sleepy." And the only place we could find open was a bowling alley. We went in to get us a cup of coffee, and he said, "You think I'd better call Diane?" And I said, "It'd be a good, pretty good idea." So he got up, and he's got a marvelous sense of humor. Went to the telephone and called her, and she said, "Where are you?" And he said, "In Anniston, Alabama, and Mom and I decided we'd just stop and bowl a game." But we finally made it. And I was back home. And during him, 1 year later, he went to New England. Left me in Atlanta. But, of course, as soon as I got there, I got a job, went to work. And I got feeling bad one day. And I had a stroke. And when I was ready to leave the hospital, Tom and my daughter-in-law Diane took me home with them. And the next morning, he came in and sat down on the side of the bed. And he said, "Now, Mom, you're going to have to quit your job." And I started crying. And he said, "What in the heck are you crying about?" And I said, "I can't live on my income without working. The income's just not enough. I've got to work." And he looked at me and he said, "You're always saying the serenity prayer, and let's see if you really believe it." And he and the younger boy got together and they worked things out. And from that day to this, on the first of every month, I get a check from each one of them. You think I don't have a lot of gratitude, you're wrong. They have been so good to me. They have provided me with a place to live that I couldn't have done it by myself. There's no way. My youngest son used to tell me when he was about 12, 13 years old, "Mom, by the time I'm 50, I'm going to be a millionaire." And of course, I just laughed. I said, "Fine. We'll all live how long?" Well, he'll be 50 years old the 28th of this month. And he's made it. And the surprising thing is, when I had my birthday last year, Evan came to give me my chip. And he got up and he said, "My name is Evan Lindsay, and I'm probably an alcoholic, but I haven't had a drink for 2 years. And it was all I could do to even say thank you when he handed me that chip. I broke down. He didn't come into AA, still hasn't. But he hadn't had a drink now in over 3 years. More power to him if that's the way he wants it. But I wouldn't have missed what I found here for anything in the world. The gratitude is overwhelming. And I have been having some health problems the last month. My sciatica's been acting up and darned old arthritis, and I wish that Frenchman would go back to Louisiana. I keep telling him that, but he won't go. So I haven't been feeling too good. I haven't been able to sleep. And Marguerite and I had talked about coming here, and I should have stayed at home, but I'm awfully glad I didn't, because I thoroughly enjoyed this. And I'm real happy I came. And I'm not going home till tomorrow because I've got 2 grandsons here and a great-grandbaby. And I'm going out and spend the night with them and go home tomorrow. But one other thing I want to tell you about. 2 years ago, suddenly I realized I wasn't seeing. And a friend took me to an eye specialist. and I learned that I had macular degeneration. The left eye's gone completely, and the right eye's about half the vision it should be. And when we got home, she said, "You think I ought to call Tom?" And I said, "Yeah, you can call him." So I got on the phone, and he said, "Mom, you want me to come?" I said, "There's nothing you can do." He said, "Okay." He was on the next plane. He came down and took over. And I had had a king-size bed for several years, and I had just gotten rid of it and gotten a queen-size. And I think he got tired of tucking the king-size blanket in, so he went down to the store and bought a queen-size and brought it home and fixed it on my bed. And the next day, he went out and he bought a telephone, one with big letters and speed dials. And when he was taking it out of the box, I said, "Tom, how much did that cost?" He looked at me and said, "None of your damn business." And he was in the kitchen doing the cooking. He's a good cook. And my youngest son came over and they were in the kitchen talking up a storm. And I yelled at him and I said, "Come in here a minute." I was in the living room, and they came in, and I said, "You know, I've just been thinking, most of the women in my family die in the early 80s, so y'all won't have to put up with me too much longer." Tom had a dish rag in his hand, and he said, "You want me to stuff this down your throat?" He just doesn't take anything off of me. But that's the sort of thing I've had in this program. Everybody in New England knows I'm in AA. I have absolutely no anonymity up there at all. The ones who Tom doesn't tell, my daughter-in-law does. And that was another blessing. She's not a daughter-in-law, she's a daughter. And I get the sweetest, dearest letters from her. And she calls me frequently. But the first summer they were up there, they sent me a plane ticket to come up. Diane sent it. And when I opened it up and looked at it, I was absolutely astounded. It was for 6 weeks. And when I got up there, I said, "Diane, you just paid me the highest compliment in the world." She said, "What's that, Mom?" I said, "There are very few daughter-in-laws that want their mother-in-law around for 6 weeks. She grinned. She said, "If you were the usual kind of mother-in-law, I wouldn't want you either." And I have to tell you about the light of my life. My little granddaughter. I've got 7 grandchildren, but I never was around most of them until they were grown. And this one, I took care of for a few months when she was born, after her mother went back to work. And she is, as I said, the light of my life. She's not only smart, but she's lovable. And I've had the pleasure. This is the daughter of the son I was telling you about that's made so darn much money. But she's just such a sweet child and just as smart as she can be and does more things than any kid I ever saw. I don't know how she does it all. She takes dancing, she takes music, she plays soccer. She just does it all. And her older brother, graduated from Vanderbilt last year. Magna cum laude, you think I wasn't walking 6 feet off the ground when we went up there for graduation. And she adores him. She called me on the phone and she said, "Grandma, you know Mark stayed at Vanderbilt to do some research with one of the professors." And I said, "Yes." She said, "He just called and he's been accepted at the University of Virginia for a double degree. He's going to get an MD and a PhD. Grandma, he's going to be doctor." So those boys have brought an awful lot of love and an awful lot of pleasure to my life. And I am truly, truly grateful. God has blessed me so much, so very much. And one of these days, I'm going to those pearly gates that Evelyn was talking about. I'm not ready yet, but one of these days, and I know for a fact that I'll find what again. Thank you.
Thank you, Lucille. I bet you don't know this, but some of the things you do, we know about. Betty and I have been to the Oakwood home. Do you know where that is?
Yes, and I'm going back to home.
This is a recovery center for halfway house for women, and Lucille, I believe, was their first director. And we've been there. And we have one more speaker. What's his name?
Somebody told me it was her.
Oh, it's Cersei. This is a great guy, and he's worked so hard to get all this together, and he's had more trouble than the law allows, you know, with the hotel. The hotel had problems with the air conditioning and it was hot here. And I think really that our Heavenly Father arranged that, because I think that it's kind of preparing some of us of where we're going to go after. Let's hear it for Cersei.
Yeah, I'll bet you'd be glad when this is over. Yeah, my name is Cersei, and I'm an alcoholic. You wouldn't believe that looking at my face, but it's got a lot of alcoholic miles on it, you know. And but I have not had a drink. Some guy said he had a drink, but it wasn't necessary. But I haven't had a drink because I found Alcoholics Anonymous May the 10th, 1946. That, by way of an announcement and gratitude, is that we have had, we can't count them all, 574 registered people, but look at this, 3,273.6 years of sobriety.
Wow!
Well, I know you're getting tired, you want to go home, and you're sick and tired of this heat. And we all are. Maybe we can. I'm not going to talk. They only gave me an hour and 30 minutes. So goodbye. Yeah. No. Not Marge. No. But I want to recognize some things that's happened to me in the last, especially 5 years. About 5 years ago, the judicial courts here established a place out at Wilmer, Texas. There was an old Bader Parkside Lodge where the alcoholic could go and sober up. And the district courts converted it to a place called Intervention, where if you have 4, 5, or 6 DWIs or whatever it is, a lot of them, and you got to have a lot of trouble, the courts send you out there for 6 months, and then they give you a place to stay for another 45 days till you get a job. It's one of the finest establishments I've ever seen for alcoholics, except those 4 clinics I had. But those guys go out there, and a lot of them stay sober. A lot of them don't. And maybe it's because we don't take the right message, but old Bobby Johnston and myself and a guy named Jack, I've been going out there 5 years, and a lot of them have found sobriety, and a lot of them are here this morning. Stand up, you guys from Intervention, stand up, will you? A very brief idea of where I came from and why. I'm really not a city boy. I live in Dallas now for 40 or some odd years, but I came originally from Funston. Now, it's not a hell of a lot bigger than La Mesa. But I noticed we didn't have any pep squad from Funston or La Mesa, either one, the other day. I was raised on a farm out there, and a sorry farm at that. I've never seen a good farm, though. I hated the dadgum farm. And we had there's 7 of we kids, and we had to make a living on 160 acres of sorry. It wouldn't grow peanuts. They're just sorry as hell. And my mother used to say I was more of a planter than I was a farmer. I planted it and hoped to hell it didn't grow. By way of recognition, we are very careful in this and have been for 10 years, except 1 year old D.H. Sneed showed up here from Andrews. He lives in Andrews, Evelyn?
Seagrave.
And he has 52 years of sobriety, and he's a great AA, and I remember he showed us how to hold a meeting when we first started AA in Lubbock, Texas. In 1946. By the way, I'm not going to go into a long drunkologue, I hope, and I know you do. But on that farm out there, and my father and mother were devout Baptists, and I'm a recovering Baptist. My dad told me if I ever took one drink of alcohol, I'd go straight to hell. So I just started going to hell, and I hadn't stopped until I got found AA. But I found out that alcohol would do for me what I couldn't do for myself. And I found it would do a lot of things to me that would make you mad as hell at me, too. And I caught hell on that, too. Well, anyhow, I got off that farm finally and went to Stanford, Texas to finish high school. And finally they burned the building down. I got out of high school. And the day I got out, I had a contract to play baseball, semi-pro baseball in the old West Texas League in Midland, Texas. And I went out there and played baseball, and they also gave us a job. I had no salary playing baseball, but they got us a job. They wanted to be damn sure we had some income, so they got us a job. And I got a job with this motor company. And in playing baseball, I'll give you an idea about early alcoholics and how they do. This guy named Red Hill that played third base for us was a sorry drinker. And I never liked a sorry drinker. If you couldn't drink a lot of booze and just stand up and keep going and raise hell, I didn't have much use for you. You know, well, Red was a sorry drink. He'd drink about, and we drank home brew. old Gene might had a little homebrew. Not very many would be old enough to. Well, anyhow, it's made out of yeast and hops and gin. I don't know what all is. And macaroni and cheese. And it ferments and it'll make you drunk. That I know. It'll make you drunk. It's about 20% alcohol. Those good home brewers made it where even up to 30 or 40% alcohol. It'll make you drunk. Well, this combination, our baseball manager had a funeral parlor. And that a hell of a combination, a baseball manager and a funeral parlor director. Well, anyhow, he was a good guy, and each Sunday evening we would gather at the funeral parlor and drink home brew. That's a hell of a place to drink, too, isn't it? But we drank, and we'd get drunk. Well, this Sunday night after the baseball game, old Red Hill had about three or four home brews, and he passed out, just lively, like he always did. Lying in the floor and all slobbering at the mouth like a lot of us do. And we decided we would cure him of such things. And we put him in a casket at the funeral parlor. And we laid him out real nice, crossed his arms and everything. sprayed a little perfume on him and whatever they do in funeral parlors, you know. And we stood back and acting silly and drinking his home brew and said, we'll wait and see what Red has to say. We stepped back and drinking and acting silly. And finally, Red came to a little. And he looked up and looked out, and he could see the wall and the ceiling, and he fell to the casket, and he fell around. And he said, if I'm not dead, why am I here? And he said, if I am dead, why have I got to go to the bathroom? I hope he later found AA. I had a good job with a motor company there in Midland, and soon the baseball played out. We played in a cow pasture. We didn't have like Texas Stadium out here. We played in a cow pasture, and a lot of cows roamed out there. And sometimes during the ball game, with baseball, run into the cow and stuff like that. Well, what ended my baseball career, I slid into what I thought was third base. And I just quit the baseball after that. I stayed there for several years and became manager and general manager of this large concern automotive company. And I had plenty of money, and I had a lot of, it was all drinking money. And I had to drink to hold my job to entertain my customers, you know. You wouldn't want a customer not to be entertained, so I entertained them. And especially those who could really drink and drink a lot. I entertained and then I drank and drank and drank. So take you down the road to how you develop alcoholism. If you have that X factor in your life, whatever that is, nobody knows yet that I know of. But if you have that and you keep adding large doses of alcohol to it over a certain period of time, depending on you, then you may become an alcoholic. You may cross that line into compulsive pathological drinking. That's the only kind of drinking that's a disease. And I had this disease, I mean, all the way. I just couldn't get enough out. I, from the beginning, who in the hell would ever want to take a couple of drinks? But yet, I lied about that. I'd come home drunk as hell, and they would say, you're drunk. And I said, I only had a couple. Two is all I ever had. But then I found this jewel, little nagging Al-Anon, Margaret, and we married. And I promised to cut out on my drinking. I promised. You know, at certain ages, you'd rather have a promise than a proposition. But I promised everything, but I never made a commitment. I didn't know anything about how not to drink. And I organized parties. I did all that. So anyhow, then the thing to do when you get fired or when you lose your job, then you take the geographical cure. You know what that is? That's unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. And I took the geographical cure, and I went to Corpus Christi, and I hired out to a big, I was the credit manager of the Packard Company down there. Packard Automobile. Long, sorry automobile. They wasn't worth a damn, but they gave me one, and I'd load it with whiskey and drive out on the King Ranch and drink and stay out there a couple of weeks. Here's what you run into, narrow-minded employers. And I'd spend a couple of weeks out there on the ranch with booze and some cheese and crackers and just drink. And then you come in a couple of weeks later, they want to know where you've been. And they just don't trust you. And I lose that job and I go on down. I wind up driving a pickle truck. And the reason for that was it was out of the city. And I could go out of the city and deliver these gallons of pickles and onions and stuff like that. And I didn't want anybody to see me, you know, a CEO like I was and a great guy. And all. Who in the hell want to see me driving a pickle truck, you know? And except my friends, they're glad to see it. Well, anyhow, I got fired from that job because, and this is another narrow-minded employer, I took that load of pickles and onion and stuff down Mexico and I traded it for booze. And I came back to Corpus Christi and this narrow-minded fellow that I worked for had me put in jail. And I thought it was a pretty good deal, you know, when you trade mustard and pickles for onions and onions for booze, that's a pretty good deal to me. And, well, anyhow, let me show you how we get hurt. My wife worked for lawyers. She was a court reporter and worked in the county and all that stuff, legal. And she could have worked for 400 different lawyers in Corpus Christi, Texas. But she worked for the dadgum law firm that represented the guy that ran off with a pickle truck. And you wind up in jail. And my brother, and she and my brother decided I needed that geographical cure again. So I came to Dallas and worked out here in a plant during the war. And finally I called for my induction papers, and to my astonishment they sent them. And I got in the service. I was 33 years old and I'd been drunk about 18 years. So you can imagine that basic training, what it did to me. Oh, I ran around, my tongue lolled out, and so tired I couldn't drink, and I that's damn tired, you know. But I couldn't. And anyhow, after about a year, they decided if they were going to win the war, they better get rid of me. And that's what they did. I came back and we went out to Lubbock, Texas. They transferred me to Lubbock, Texas to work for Electric Autolite Company. In the summer of 45, I ran into an old drinking buddy of mine in Odessa, Texas. And I said, come have a drink with me. He said, I'm not drinking today, I'll go with you. And we went up and I asked him, he wouldn't drink. And I said, what's wrong? What kind of venereal disease you got? And there's bound to be something wrong or he'd be drinking. Well, anyhow, he explained that he belonged to a bunch of fellas in Dallas that had found a way to stay sober. And he said, when you go as far as you can go, you come see me and I'll try to help you. Well, that was in August of 45, and he sent me the big book, and I admonished him not to send it to my home. My wife would think I had a drinking problem, you know. But he sent it to Amarillo, and I picked it up, and I read it like this. And I knew it all. And I took it home and hid it where I hid my whiskey, and she found it. My wife found it. And that's what saved our marriage for a little while, anyhow. But she read it and found out that I had an illness and that I couldn't help doing what I was doing. But that I could be helped and that I was worth helping. And so, I then in November of that year, I lost that job. And an attorney and myself in Lubbock, Texas, we'd get a quart of whiskey every morning and go to his office and drink it and get some more. But I went home drunk every day from then until April 1946. And that moment of clarity came to me. It said in his office that morning, this has got to stop. And I remembered what Bob told me, when you go as far as you can go, call me. I got on a plane, came to Dallas. And he put me on Saturday, he took in an ambulance out to an old drying up joint here, over here on Maple Avenue, off of Maple. And then the third day they took me downtown, said, we're going to take you to AA. So we got in the car and went downtown to 912 and a half Main, and we parked in front of a liquor store. And I said, this AA thing may work. But we didn't go in the liquor store, we climbed the stairs and went up to the club, and at the top of the door it said, welcome, you're home. And that's the first time I'd seen a welcome sign turned around where I could read it in a long time. It'd been a long time. And they went in there, thank God, here's what, every single one of you can make a difference. Every single one of you are the only one that can help that somebody there. You're the only one, nobody else. Everybody else can try to work on it, but you're the only one that can make that and make that person know they can stay sober. So I got that guy, Burl McInerney. And he took me and he said, can you go a day without drinking? I said, I can go a day, but I can't go a week. I can't go a month. I can go a day, yeah. Well, he said, I want you to first surrender that you've got a problem. And second, he said, I want you to accept what you've got. And third, I want you to commit to staying sober on a daily basis. Make that commitment in the morning. Thank God that night, and you'll never take another drink. And I've never had another when he told me that. I didn't know how not to drink. So he took me to the board and said, I don't want you to work these steps. You're not capable. But I want you to read them, and I want you to get ready. You're going to have to do those steps. And so then they said, we AAs help each other. We'll go any length to help another drunk. And he said, I want to give you the names of four members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they were between Fort Worth and Phoenix, Arizona. There was not one group, not one group. There were four members. There was one in Coleman, Texas, one in Big Spring. There was one, a member in Plainview, and Bob Doris in Clovis, New Mexico. And they were the only four members between Fort Worth and Phoenix. And that's a hell of an arid country, you know. So I went back to Lubbock. And I would get on the bus and come to meetings down here in Dallas every 30 days, whether I needed a meeting or not, I'd just come in. And then they taught us, they came out from Dallas and Fort Worth, and to help us organize a group. We didn't know how. We didn't know how to hold a meeting. We didn't know how to do anything. So they'd come help us, and we started, and the group started. And old D.H. Sneed would come down. He lived in Monahan at that time. Come down, the guy that says 52 years now. He'd come down and help us hold a meeting and show us how to hold a meeting. And then finally the group grew, and we started a group in Midland. We started in Odessa, and all of this just mushroomed. Everybody, all those drunks were looking just like me for a way to not drink. And all they needed was a place to go find out. And we let them know. Then we got Bill Wilson to come to Texas in 1948. And by that time we were having a convention in Lubbock, not a convention, just a gathering. We had a hell of a crowd. We had about 50 people. And from all over Texas, they came to see how Bill's wings flopped, you know. And they found out. And old Bill sat down with us just like one of us, and we talked about how to stay sober and how he stayed sober, and gave us the basic principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God. We found out exactly the way we needed to do to stay sober. And that's so important. And he was the only guy right then that could have done it, because we didn't know. Well, the groups grew, and anyhow, Bill, coming to Texas, I met him in Amarillo. And he and Lois came down to go to Lubbock. We got back on the plane, and he said, here, here are some things I want you to read, see what you think about it. And he handed it to me on the plane to level. And I read it, and I said, well, Bill, this is fine, but we don't need it down here. I can understand you damn Yankees fighting. I can understand you not doing what we're supposed to do, but we love each other down here. Oh, do we love each other. And he said he took them back. I got them back later, but he took them back. What it was the 12 traditions that he had written. He and Dr. Bob had gone over and said, this is what we need to save Alcoholics Anonymous. And aren't you glad I didn't start this damn thing? Done screwed up good. Well, Bill came down and talked with us and helped us. And we had, as I say, about 50 people there. Well, after then and down the line, Bill invited me to Margaret and I to come up to see he and Lois, and I have had the privilege of all those years. There's only one thing I'm sorry of. I didn't get to visit Dr. Bob no more, but it just happened that Bill and Lois took Margaret and I in, and we went to visit their home, Stepping Stone, many, many times. And I followed old Bill around like a little puppy dog. I want to know all these facts and figures and how about his spiritual experience and all that stuff. And he would tell me, and it was good. And I asked him so damn many questions. He said, do you want to know? I figured if I knew all about alcoholism, I could save the world. I could go in these bars. And he was telling about Bill would franchise this thing. We might franchise it and make a hell of a deal out of it, you know. So Bill told me, said, if I were you, your lack of knowledge of what you think and what you need to know, I'd go to Yale and study alcoholism. So I said, all right, how do I go? And he said, I'll get you a scholarship. And he got me a scholarship, and I went up there and came back. And you talk about knowledge. I had it. Boy, there was nothing like it. And that's where I started out, and that's where I met Dr. Jeeves. He was a promising young doctor in Tahoka, Texas. But he didn't have any problem. He was just drinking too much. And I put him to sleep. But we went all over God's green earth. We went all over God's green earth preaching the gospel. And because Dr. Jelinek, head of the Yale School, hired me and Horace Fort at TCU at Fort Worth to carry this message of alcoholism recovery. So we established that alcoholism is a disease and the alcoholic is a sick person. The alcoholic can be helped and they're worth helping. And alcoholism is a community problem, therefore a community responsibility. Those were the things. We went all over God's world and I think instead of carrying the message, we spread the disease. But anyhow, we had a lot of fun. And then I established those. Dr. Gellner helped when he became ill in 1950. We established a clinic in Lubbock where he said the greatest need we have is a place for the alcoholic to go and get sober and go into AA. And that a scientist coming from a scientist, you know, that they deal in facts. Old Dr. Jelinek I traveled with him many, many miles. He was a great old man. He loved AA. And he, formerly in South America, he was a banana scientist. And then he went to Yale as an alcoholism scientist. And I asked him, what the hell, how did you ever go from bananas to alcoholics? And he said, they're just alike. They get away from the bunch and get peeled. That's real. Well, in those clinics, we sobered up one here in Dallas, one in Lubbock, Houston, and in those places, the drunks would come in, and they had the finest medical treatment you could have, and they stayed 1 week, and there were AAs in there day and night. A lot of them said it's more like a honky-tonk than it is a recovery center. They're in there talking all night. But they went to AA and they took them to AA and 75% of them stayed sober. And that was an amazing thing at how they recovered. Well, those things happen, those commitments. Let me talk about a little bit, so I hope I don't talk all day. That's my wife applauding. Making those commitments and how to do it is the responsibility of all of us. If we don't tell that newcomer how not to drink on it, and I always wonder at every meeting we have, sometimes we get into marriage counseling and all that crap, and that we have no business in, and I wonder, what if that new guy or gal is here and they come in here to find out, how do I not drink on a daily basis? How do I not drink? And that's what if I'd heard something else when I came the first time, I probably wouldn't have come back. But I heard how not to drink on a daily basis. How not to drink. And that's what I needed to know. Out of the steps, I didn't know anything about. I didn't have sense enough to know anything. But I wanted to know, how can I not drink, and then go into these things that help us recover. So, a lot of good things happened down, a lot of memories, a lot of things like Evelyn's talking about at Seminole. We would go 350 miles to a meeting to help establish a group. We'd do anything in the world, and I've done that all of my, ever since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've had the privilege of doing those things, and to all the conventions and all of this and that, and I've just been lucky to having had a relationship with Bill. And then in 1950, at the International Conference, after I had said all these things about we didn't need the tradition, Dr. Bob Bell took me up in the room at Cleveland and said, "We want you to get out on the floor and electioneer to try to get these traditions passed. We don't know whether they're passed or not. There may be some of these grunted guys like you that in the beginning, you know, that said we don't need them." So I was down on the floor circulating to the 12 traditions. We got to get this passed. Well, they had the vote that afternoon. The guy had two or three talks. And Bill talked and Dr. Bob talked. And then they said, "We're going to vote now whether to accept or reject the 12 traditions." Well, they had a standing vote and not a single dissenting vote. Here I was down there working my ass off, and nobody was against it at all. That is the day that saved AA. The day Bob and Bill met is the time that saved us. And the day that we voted the 12 traditions is what will forever save Alcoholics Anonymous, if we will adhere to those traditions. And we must do it. And I thank God for the traditions, because the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. The only requirement. But the requirement to stay sober is different. You can say, I can say I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, but if I stay sober, then I have to give of myself. I have to share the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous with somebody else. And like we've talked, I've heard several talk, the only way we can alleviate our pain of being an alcoholic is when you're trying to help somebody else. The only way. If you're not as close to God as you once were, make no mistake about who's moved. And if you never were close to God, make no mistake about who should move. I have noted that those in Alcoholics Anonymous who find a good relationship with a power greater than themselves is more successful in sobriety. Have you noticed that? It always happens. Unless we find a relationship that we're comfortable with the higher power, our success in sobriety is not too good. They're not too good. So, Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life. And all the accolades about being 50 years sober and all those things, I have to remember, yeah, but 50 years ago you were a sloppy, sorry drunk. 50 years ago, you didn't have good clothes. You didn't have a car. You didn't have a job. You didn't have anything. And I have to remember, I've got on a clean shirt this morning, but you should have seen me 50 years ago today. Slobbered all over. Drunk. Worthless. No good to anybody. And when you find a new life, and when you find that there is life, and that you have been on the wrong track, and that you have found a way to live, that you don't need alcohol anymore by the grace of God. So, as we celebrate this meeting, and as we celebrate what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous, we've got to remember that the bottom line is it all comes from a power greater than ourselves. Whatever power you choose, however you choose to do with that power, that's your prerogative. But we need to have a contact. We need to, our groups. And everybody, you know, if we're talking about this morning not liking the group, and Ms. Kay talking about running off from her La Mesa group, you know, all you got to do is have a coffee pot and a resentment, start you a new group. And it works. Somehow it works. Everything works in AA if and provided we stay with our principle. Look what happened to the Oxford movement. Look what happened to the Washingtonian movement. What did happen? They promoted their leaders. They forgot about what they were there for. They went into politics. They went into religion. They went into marriage counseling. They went into all these things sometimes we do. But and then so did the Oxford movement. They came down. What happened? Yes. The same thing. We strayed away from our principles. We strayed away from what we're here for. So, I have to tell you that one day in 1953, Bill Wilson was here. We were visiting, and I have some pictures of that meeting we had then. I asked Bill the question. I said, AA's been around 11 years. What would you rather see happen than anything that's ever happened? He said, I'd rather see Abby have a chance to get sober. Let's go back. Abby in 1934, Abby came to visit Bill in the hospital, in town hospital. Bill was there for the 39th time. And then Bill went out, and Abby, while there, he came in. Abby, this old schoolmate, Abby Thatcher, that you read about, came in, and Bill said, what is this religion you got? He said, well, it's not religion, but it's something like religion. We have the four absolutes, and we heard about those yesterday in the talk. Absolute purity, absolute honesty, absolute all these things. And Bill said, hell, an alcoholic can't absolutely do anything. You know. So we have those. Anyhow, Abby told Bill, he said, how do you work? Why does this thing work? And then how do you work? And he said, we trust God and clean house. You know, we haven't improved on that any yet. We trust God and clean house. And Bill thought about that, and Abby went out. Bill comes back for the 40th time in town's hospital. The doctor comes in. You're hopeless and helpless. You're nothing short of a spiritual experience will save you. So Bill got on his knees that night, and he said, if, with a big question mark, if there is a God, show himself to me. And God did. Read it in the big book. A soft wind blew over him. And all the lights flashing. I've had a lot of hot flashes, but that's my age. But old Bill had a real spiritual experience that some of us look for, but we don't have. We have a recovery by awakening as a result of these 12 steps. So, anyhow, Bill, isn't that amazing? He never needed another drink. Never needed another drink. And that's the amazing thing when you have a spiritual. And I think that by doing these 12 steps, experiencing those, not memorizing, not reading them, not knowing them, but experiencing those 12 steps, we come to the realization that we can eliminate the need for a drink on a daily basis if we trust in God and clean house. Right? So, And closing, we got people here from Chicago and everywhere else, And we have put 8 or 10 states are represented here with a lot of sobriety. And I'm sure glad we got them here. Bob, I've heard Bob Smith many times because he was in a service of our country during World War II. And I think about what happens to us of holding AA together. And those of us who have blazed the trail maybe in front and you who come along behind. And Bob, I'm reminded of the poem about Flanders Field and those who fought in Flanders Field and they died, but they said, you got to keep on going. You got to go forward. And this is what is said, in Flanders Field the poppies grow. Between the crosses row on row that mark our places, and in the skies the lark still bravely singing fly. Scarce heard amidst the guns below, we're the dead. Short days ago we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved, but now we fly in Flanders Field. Take up the quarrel with the foe, to you with fading hands we throw the torch. Be it yours to hold high, if ye break faith with us who die, ye shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders Field. Take up the cross, take up the things that have been given us along the line to those who came before us. Follow those directions, and if we will do that and stay with the 12 steps, the 12 traditions, we will all stay sober. And I have no doubt about that. So, also, we've been singing around here, and my favorite song, this guy, Stuart Hamblin, that I finished high school with in Stanford, wrote a lot of spiritual songs. And like This Old House and stuff like that. He wrote religious songs for the movies. And he died sober 2.5 years when he died. And I told him this song that he wrote, it is no secret what God can do. I thought he wrote it for AA. And I told him so before he died. And you know, it goes like this. The chimes of time ring out the news another day is through. Someone slipped and fell. Was that someone you? You may have longed for added strength, your courage to renew. Do not be disheartened, because I've got news for you. It is no secret what God can do. What he's done for others, he'll do for you. And there is no night, for in his light you'll never walk alone. You'll always feel at home wherever you may roam. There is no power can conquer you while God is on your side. Just take him at his promise. Don't run away and hide. It is no secret what God can do. What he's done for others, he'll do for you. With arms wide open, he'll pardon you. It is no secret what God can do. So I have no doubt in my mind that as we abandon ourselves to God, as we understand God, clear away the wreckage of the past, and as we trudge down that road to happy destiny, that we all have joyous, happy, and free, I have no doubt that all of us will meet in the big meeting. And for that, thank God, and thank God for all of you. Thank you.